Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
This week, Microsoft has a new CEO, Facebook turns 10 and releases a new app, the NSA plays favorites with Yahoo, and visitors to Russia find they have no privacy at all. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. Add us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. I didn't talk to you beforehand about what we're playing with. Are you playing with anything particular this week?
Yeah, I got a little toy. I got a Nest Learning Thermostat.
Oh, you got a Nest!
Yeah, you know.
Nice. It's
2.0. I mean, it was actually, I gotta say, it was, I bought it right before the purchase of Nest by Google. Basically came in the mail the next couple of days that I spent the last week kind of like tweaking it, learning with it. It wasn't the easiest thing to just pick out because Honeywell has a highly reviewed thermostat. That's also
a learning thermostat. Right?
It's also a connected thermostat. It's not learning, but it's connected. And for a lot of people, the learning feature of Nest is not one they really want. They want this Honeywell thing. So if you hop on Amazon, look at the Honeywell connected thermostat for $200 and the Nest for $250, the reviews are pretty partisan on both. Both of them have tons of reviews, hundreds.
Sure.
And the Honeywell has great, great has great reviews. It's a more traditional looking thermostat. It's a little less, nouveau, trendy looking, whatever. But it's got an app. It connects to the Revolve system, which is huge connected smart home company out of Boulder. And, it's got open APIs, which Nest doesn't have yet, and all these things. So a lot of people are really into the idea that they program their thermostat settings. Whereas with Nest, it's supposed to focus on not you programming it, but it programming itself based on what it believes your behavior to be. So there's very different philosophies. For me, I would say my chief thing right now, because I'm in Boulder and it's -1 degrees, is that I'm able to flip a switch on my phone or tablet at any given time and crank the heat up or down wherever. The first 90 days of having a Nest require a lot of fine-tuning as the computer asks you to kind of pay special attention to it so it could really learn your habits. But all in all, it's been a great experience. The installation could have been easier, but having to convert this sort of ancient HVAC tech into new connected tech, that's a big deal. and they do it pretty well. So all in all, I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I had a Nest. I think I still do. It's probably in a box somewhere.
What? I could have bought it from you.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't know. Maybe we didn't spend enough time with it, but we didn't get it. It never sort of fine-tuned itself. It was always running too hot or running too cold, and it was like we had it for like a couple of weeks and still didn't really never calibrated itself. But we also have some weird airflow issues in our house, so it may have been an intractable solution with the way we've got the air going through our house.
Do you have a one zone house or a two zone house?
We have a one zone house.
Gotcha. I gotta say the next place I live in will probably be a two zone space. Because I don't know if listeners know this, but thermostats are funny things. As a tech person, you think, okay, computer tells house to be a certain degree.
Yeah.
Computer uses, gas, oil, whatever you got to kind of just, balance it. If it's not where it should be, you're going to kick it on or kick it down or whatever. But it's a lot more barbaric than that. And really what ends up happening is that the one thermostat, basically where it is, mm-hmm. is where the temperature, where the requested temperature is. And in a one zone house, you could have two floors, three floors, whatever, you know, a couple floors up, it's warmer, a couple floors down, it's lower. It's colder. So the house is never the actual temperature you ask for unless you're standing right next to the thermostat. In a two-zone setup, they're basically two thermostats, two yeah. HVAC pipes, all that stuff is mm-hmm. set up so that you know, the heat on the second floor, for instance, is going to be exactly what that second floor thermostat asks for, and the heat on the first floor is exactly what that asks for too. Nest is interesting because if you want, without having two zones set up, you know, the HVAC pipes and everything, you can actually set up two Nest thermostats, one upstairs, one downstairs, and they will talk to each other and find an average heat. So if you've said how you want the house to be at 70 degrees, the Nest upstairs is hanging out at 73, the Nest downstairs is hanging out at like 64, that's what the temperatures are, they will find a place where they're in between those two numbers across their respective areas. And that's an interesting piece that it seems that Nest is doing alone because of the connectivity that they have and, you know, the software gurus over there. So, oh no, I'm fairly excited about this device. It's part of my slow movement toward complete home automation. The really big thing that I wish I had, you know, I've got Wemos, I've got Insteon, I got all this crap, but the really big thing I wish I had was a Wi-Fi connected vacuum cleaner.
Interesting. How would that work exactly?
It'd be a robot like my Roomba.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of an upright. Yeah, no, of course, yeah. A Roomba. Yeah.
But Roomba, they don't, I mean, they have these $600 vacuum cleaners that have no connectivity, which to me is interesting because everything is connected.
Sure.
And yeah, it'd be great to know that, oh, I'm coming home. The Roomba runs on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It's a Thursday, but yeah. The fact is, I got some company coming. So why don't you just do a quick sweep around that floor that you're on, Mr. Roomba, or you know whatever.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Or just having the stats of it ran, and this is what happened. Oh, it got caught on something. So this is, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
It'd just be helpful to have all that. But yeah, that's what I'm playing with this week. The Nest. Learning thermostat second generation.
Cool. Awesome. Well, like I said, I'm not playing with anything this week other than just continuing the digitizing, the ripping of my CDs. So why don't we jump right into headlines? Big headline right off the bat. Technology giant Microsoft has announced that Satya Nadella will be its next chief executive. He's currently the Microsoft's head of cloud and enterprise, which builds and runs the firm's computing and developer platforms. He takes over from Steve Ballmer, who announced plans to step down last year. Bill Gates, company founder Bill Gates, said there was no better person to lead Microsoft. He was born in Hyderabad, joined the company in 1992, and has degrees in electronics, computer science, and business administration. Bill Gates is stepping down as chairman, it was also announced, but will take up a new role as technology advisor and will also retain a seat on the Microsoft board. This move seems designed in part to assure people inside and outside of Microsoft that Microsoft is in good hands, even as a relatively unknown figure moves into the Microsoft CEO office, a position held by only two people previously. Steve Gates and Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, of course. What do you think? You think what I found interesting about this was that they chose someone who was the head of cloud and enterprise, and these are both arenas that it looks like Microsoft is gearing their business more into than software and devices.
Well, Microsoft has always been in the enterprise space, right? They've been putting together Windows Server. Office is rolled out. There's Office Enterprise. There's, you know, Windows Enterprise. You know, people buy home or professional, but there's also an enterprise version. So it's been a big piece for them. In 2010 and 11, when the word cloud started being bandied about popularly,
yeah.
It became pretty clear that the enterprise needed solutions that were server-side, that they didn't want to manage, and that it was scalable that way. And, you know, the fact that that Microsoft was able to move in that direction and eventually offer consumer-based services like, you know, Live and Live Drive and all that stuff, that was pretty big deal. The fact that Mr. Nadella was able to run those things and bring those things to fruition is helpful. Now, he had the backing of the enterprise work that Microsoft was doing already. You know, like his division was able to subsidize itself, I'm sure. But for me, this is important mostly because, like you said, there have been two CEOs of Microsoft before, Ballmer and Gates. And while Gates had the founding vision and wanted to walk away, Ballmer was sort of the guy who became the made man and seemed to make somewhat not rational decisions when it came to certain products. Sure. Having Nadella be there, having him be not some guy who ran away from Microsoft like Elop and then was brought back, having him be someone who's been in Microsoft for a while, it's going to help with morale internally. I'm sure a lot of people were like, this is a great guy. I like working with this guy for this guy. He's one of, you know, he's in the family. That's all going to work. Whereas Elop kind of been like, yeah, I'm out of there. I'm doing Nokia. Nokia failed, but what's up? So that's going to help with morale. But I also think this is going to help in terms of not just the fact that he's a CEO, but the fact that Bill Gates, I'm sorry, is coming back as a technical advisor.
Yeah.
A lot of this work, these changes have to do with Microsoft stock price, the way the shareholders feel, and its position in technology. They've released some new ads. They've released new things showing what they're capable of doing and everything. But they need to show new blood that's trained in-house, and they need to show that they're not being abandoned by founders, the founders having just left, especially in an age where Tim Cook continues to get a lot of guff for not being Steve Jobs, knowing that Bill Gates is not running the show, but is, you know, consigliere, so to speak, sitting there like counseling on where the tech should go, where he sees the tech going, using that mind that like built much of the last age of technology, is going to be very helpful for Microsoft in terms of its image and the idea that there's some new blood in there, but there's some still like tradition in there, and that's, you know, that's going to be good. And it also is helpful because Bill Gates built this, and he's left mostly for this Gates Foundation, but
right,
it puts his profile up, and that lifts the profile of the Gates Foundation, so he'll be able to do more work.
What do you see Bill Gates' role in once Nadella takes over Microsoft? Like, what is he going to be? How active is he going to be? What is he going to exactly be doing?
There's no way for him to be less active than he has been in the past. I think when you've got big personalities like Gates and Ballmer, big personalities like Ballmer, really, Gates is like, look, it's your show. I trust you, man. Go ahead and do it. I'm not going to look over your shoulder. One of the big issues that the Ford CEO had when Microsoft seemed to be courting him was the fact that he was worried about having two bosses. He was worried about having Ballmer and Gates as his bosses on the board, having them not agree, having, you know, not being able to truly run the company. Bringing up a guy like Nadella obviates that problem. Nadella's going to say, look, I'm pleased to be here. I'm going to do everything I can. And then Bill Gates is going to come in as his advisor, which is probably a role that's designed to have Nadella run things. But to have Gates be able to provide a fresh perspective based on vast amounts of experience and a proven track record of being a technology visionary. So with Microsoft's connected devices, you know, the baby onesies that they have that are connected, all this other stuff like that, you know, Gates will be able to look at those and determine where the application has to be. And for at least a while, transitioning out of one department in a company to run the whole company takes a bit of help.
Sure.
You know, you're going to have to, you know, obviously he's not going to play favorites or anything, but he's going to have to step outside of his old focus. And while he's perfectly capable of that, it's a cultural thing that takes a couple, several months, if not a couple years. So we'll see how it works.
Gates is going to be holding his hand and doing some babysitting for a while. That's
I don't know if it's going to be babysitting. I think it might be more like counseling. Like when you have an RA at college.
Sure, sure, sure.
What do you want to do?
Right.
That kind of thing.
Conciliary.
Mm-hmm.
From the old Godfather days. Okay, moving on here. Fresh disclosures about national security requests indicate that Yahoo was ordered to hand over content from more accounts than other tech firms during the first 6 months of 2013. Yahoo said it was told to release content from between 30,000 to 30,999 accounts over the period under the Foreign Intelligence Service Surveillance Act. So basically what happened was they loosened the reporting that the tech companies previously they were restricted to reporting a more sort of generic general figure. And now they loosen the limits to what they could report. So we get a better breakdown of the FISA requests to the individual tech firms such as Yahoo, Microsoft, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Google. And we get to find out exactly sort of what they a better idea of how many requests were made to them.
Right, it's interesting because you basically have the government saying, okay, you can tell people how many times we've bothered you about giving us information. Can't tell them who, and you can't tell them actual numbers. You have to go ballpark in the 10,000 range. So how helpful it is in terms of actually changing our lives? Not crazy helpful in your day-to-day, but helpful enough to let you know that this is present, it's ongoing, and you can look at it. Now, the fact that Yahoo has been looked at more than others, that's interesting.
It is interesting.
Not Gmail. I mean, you look at Yahoo and their demographic, they have a lot of people around the world. Their global presence is bigger than is possibly bigger than Google on the mail side. Google became the biggest mailer fairly recently. I think it was late 2011, early 2012 or 2013 or something, but Yahoo was the biggest for quite some time, especially internationally. So if this is, this trailing information, it's helpful to know that Yahoo's there. Yahoo also has access to things like Flickr. If you're doing anything sketchy, you want to just post a picture of something that looks benign but is actually giving you information about something, there's that. So it's interesting. It'd be cool to see how this information was used. But I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon.
What was interesting about this report is the two things. First of all, they mentioned that Flickr was open to FISA investigation.
Exactly, yeah.
And that they also published a transparency report for Tumblr that states that the unit that Tumblr had never received a FISA order or an order from FISA or national security letter. So,
well, the thing about FISA, Tumblr is that Tumblr's all open. They can scan all they want with Tumblr.
Yeah.
Getting into someone's email messages requires getting through security in a wall. Getting to those pictures that are private on Flickr, same thing. You have to ask permission or you have to hack in. But Tumblr, luckily, is not very private. There's not a lot of private Tumblrs out there,
Right.
You can put your Tumblr. Say again?
You publish because you want everyone to see it on Tumblr.
Exactly. And you can have a private Tumblr. Like you can have a Tumblr that is behind a password.
Mm-hmm.
But, knowing the NSA, it's not too hard to get through. The big thing here, though, is that it's unclear how effective these numbers are when the NSA doesn't always ask permission to look for things.
Sure.
They may just go in and use these magical backdoors that they've either created or they've busted down and take the information. And it's a combination of both of them that makes their databases so so robust.
Yep. Okay, moving on here. The latest Edward Snowden-related revelation is that Britain's government communications headquarters, the GCHQ, that's their version of the NSA, proactively targeted the communications infrastructure used by the online activist collective known as Anonymous. Specifically, they implemented distributed denial of service attacks, DDoS attacks, on IRC rooms used by Anonymous. They also implanted malware to out the personal identity details of specific participants. Whether you agree with the activities of Anonymous or not, which have included everything from supporting Arab Spring protests to DDoSing copyright organization to doxing or uncovering the personal information of child pornography site users, the salient point is that democratic governments now seem to be using their very tactics against them. The key difference, however, is that while those involved in Anonymous can and have faced their day in court for those tactics, the British government has not. When Anonymous engages in lawbreaking, they're always taking a huge risk in doing so. But with unlimited resources and no oversight, organizations like the GCHQ and theoretically the NSA can do as they please, and it's this power differential that makes all the difference. There are clearly defined laws and processes that a democratic government is supposed to follow, yet here the British government is apparently throwing out due process and essentially proceeding straight to the punishment using a method that is considered illegal and punishable by years in prison. And I'm quoting from an excellent Wired article, which we'll link in the show notes. The scenario is all the more alarming given that some of Anonymous's actions may be illegal and might warrant attention from some law enforcement agencies, but do not even come close to constituting a terrorist threat. And that means we're inching into the same territory as the dictatorial regimes criticized by democratic governments for not respecting internet freedoms.
Yeah, so this is interesting. I mean, what Gabrielle Coleman's writing about on Wired sometimes comes across as, oh, strong arm, you know, people are disappearing in the night. But at the same time, Anonymous is a terrorist organization. Obviously, they're not Al-Qaeda, but they're not looked at as criminals, you know, like the kind who rob banks or whatever and have to go through due process. They're looked at as a terrorist organization. And in America and in Britain, the people who are associated with those organizations can be detained without habeas corpus, without the right to trial or really even being charged. So that's a big piece of what's happening here. Now, Anonymous has done some things that people love and that people hate. You know, they're a very diversified organization. They're kind of a non-organization organization. But in the end, when they do something, they take incredible risks in order to pull it off. And when a government can look at what they've done and, you know, move in those directions, they're going to try to catch these people and they're going to, you know, make those tactics work for them. So it's not too surprising to me. I think Anonymous is, from the perspective of freedom fighting and everything, is a very interesting concept and everything. But, you know, They're highly controversial, and governments have labeled them as terrorists, so it's not surprising that people are getting picked up and being locked away. And, you know, I definitely feel like that whole practice has to go away. It's amazing in this country that Guantanamo Bay isn't even closed yet. But, yeah, I mean, that's right. One of those things that we look at. And for me, it makes me wonder, Snowden, the editing of what he released – now, one could say he just shotgunned and said these millions of documents just have to be out there. But when you look at them and how they're being released, it's very hard to tell if there's an agenda here other than exposing everything that the U.S. government and its allies had that he can get his hands on. He's spoken about, hey, NSA needs to know, and people need to know that NSA is spying on them. But documents like this are moving away from that message. So I think as an audience, part of, you know, much of what we want is a story to be told, which he's not doing as eloquently as we may have thought in the beginning when it comes to these documents that are kind of, I'm not going to say all over the place, but highly diverse in their range and perspective.
Yeah.
You know, there's no super narrative. There's no side being taken. And I guess as an American, it's just a partisan wrangling left and right. It's sometimes difficult to conceive what his motivation is with this. The idea that his motivation is just to expose what the NSA is doing is a bit more difficult than seeing if he had like a real focus and agenda, like I want to hit these particular points and hammer it home. And it kind of dilutes, unfortunately for him, it dilutes any core message he wants, because we're chasing down Anonymous in this article and not, you know, eye on the ball when it comes to NSA and leaks and so on and so forth.
You know, there's another fascinating point that this article makes is the is about the disparity between the punishment of online crimes versus real life physical crimes. For example, he talks about in Wisconsin, a man was fined for running an automated DDoS tool against the Koch Industries website. For 60 seconds, he was protesting the Koch brothers' role in supporting the Wisconsin governor, reducing the power of unions. The actual financial losses were less than $5,000, but he was charged a fine of $183,000, even though a far worse physical crime in the same state was only fined $6,400.
What's the example of the far worse physical crime?
I don't know offhand. The it doesn't mention, but I think that basically what they're saying is that judges consider Anonymous's actions to be serious and punishable. Versus in the grand scheme of things, compared to actual physical.
Traditional crimes
against property and people.
Well, there's so much less advocacy and lobbying going on in the tech sector, and there's a lot of fear when it comes to these judges and the lawmakers and what they know and don't know about technology. But there's also, like, especially in today's world, a lot of hacking and data stealing going on. So the enforcement of crime surrounding these areas is going to be huge, and it's going to stay that way until more tech-savvy people come in and make reforms. But we don't have that. We still have the legacy of the analog 20th century dealing with the way crime is handled on these things. Now, a big piece of this is, hey, look, use your powers for good instead of evil. Protesting is protesting. Hacking is hacking. You're breaking and entering when you hack. And that's what you're doing. You're breaking and entering. If you're going to protest, you have to pay the price for it. Martin Luther King used to protest. He went to jail a whole lot. And that's kind of what how I see protests, whether it's on the internet or not. You know, I did a sit-in in high school for one reason or another. You get detention. And it's not like an insignificant crime. They want to dissuade it. So... well, I think that there is a lot of draconian law surrounding what happens with people when people do stuff on the internet. I think it's going to take some time before any of it changes.
Yeah. I think we're going to have a lot more sort of real life use cases, real life situations like this, for people to say, "Hey, that's something's wrong about the way people are being treated for these crimes that are."
I mean, this goes back to Aaron Schwartz and how he was going to go to jail for God knows how long because of exposing things. Did what he do, was it right? Perhaps, but the law just isn't on your side in this space. So you really have to take a look at the risk you're taking.
Right. Good point. Yeah, the law isn't on their side at this point. Who knows when or if that will change?
I mean, it's changed. I mean, 10 years ago, gay marriage was considered never going to happen.
Right.
And it started happening now. 50 years ago, the idea that a black guy could be president didn't happen.
Right.
These things happen over time, but the culture just isn't there yet.
Sure. Okay. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is not the book narrated, read by a narrator. This is a special edition of the original radio series, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, first broadcast on BBC Radio 4 in 1978. If you've never heard the story of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy before, it's the short version synopsis is this: seconds before the Earth is demolished to make way for a galactic freeway, Arthur Dent is plucked off the planet by his friend Ford Prefect, an alien who for the last 15 years has been posing as an out-of-work actor. Together, this dynamic pair begin a journey through space with a galaxy full of fellow travelers. Zaphod Beeblebrox, a two-headed, three-armed ex-hippie, a trillion Zaphod's girlfriend, whom Arthur once tried to pick up at a cocktail party, and Marvin, a paranoid, brilliant, and chronically depressed robot. If it sounds a little schizophrenic, it is, but it's actually fairly amazing. I don't really believe that anyone who hears the sound of my voice has not experienced Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in one form or another.
Well, I think the Hitchhiker is kind of like Doctor Who or Buffy or whatever. These are very original tales.
Yeah.
That can't be told to people. You have to. It has to be shown to people. Like you can't explain the premise of Doctor Who and have anyone get excited about it. You can't explain the right. premise of you know, Dollhouse or even Battlestar Galactica. Right. And I think that's one of the things about it. You just kind of have to experience it. Now, I've actually heard this presentation, the dramatization, so mm-hmm. to speak. It's very funny. The BBC was all over this back when it showed up. There are about five different types of Hitchhiker Guide to the Galaxy presentations, whether you're reading it in the book or listening to the original.
This was the original. This
the original or the redone ones or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all very entertaining. And it's as funny as it is bizarre. Mm-hmm, and it's mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. bizarre as it is enthralling. So it's definitely worth a listen.
It started as this radio presentation. Then it was a video mini-series, and then somewhere between the radio presentation and the video mini-series, the books were starting to be published. But it's interesting that you mention Doctor Who, because Douglas Adams, who wrote the Hitchhiker's Guide series, also wrote for Doctor Who back in the, like, the fourth
Doctor. Yeah, he lent
Doctor
a lot of his quirkiness to Doctor Who, which I think is pretty helpful. You can see that today when you look at the current Doctor Who series.
The humor that is trademark of Doctor Who.
The type of humor,
The type of humor Douglas Adams had a large part in contributing. So if you like Doctor Who, if you like quirky British humor, if you just want to be told an entertaining story, get this book. You could also choose any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles. To download that one or any other title of your choice, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And the 30-day trial will give you a chance to check out their service. It's great. I love Audible. I have it right now. I've got two credits waiting for me, so I've got two choices to make in the next month or so. So I'm excited about that. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Facebook turns 10 and celebrates with a new app. So take a listen to this and come on back. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas. Amid continued debate over whether or not Sochi is prepared to host the 2014 Olympics, reporters from all around the world are starting to check into their local hotels to their apparent grief and taking to Twitter to air that grief. Some journalists arriving in Sochi are describing appalling conditions in the housing there, where only 6 of 9 media hotels are ready for guests. Hotels are still under construction. Water, if running, isn't drinkable. One German photographer told the AP that his hotel had still had stray dogs and construction workers wandering in and out of rooms. This isn't much to do with tech, except for the fact that they're doing this over Twitter. I think both in a way, sort of partially because this is their form of communication, and also as a way of sort of publicly protesting / complaining about the conditions, exposing the conditions. There's one of these tweets that I found really sort of amazing, and that is Greg Wyshynski, who is a reporter for Yahoo Sports, tweeted a photo of his bathroom where there's a toilet stall and a toilet and a trash can in the corner of the toilet stall with a sign clearly reading, "Please do not flush toilet paper down the toilet. Put it in the bin provided."
Yeah, so I just saw that. And, I mean, tech story, sort of. The Olympics are always a tech story.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, every year these sporting events get streamed, they get tweeted, they get pushed out. It's all about how that global event is being communicated back at home and across the world. And when I look at this stuff, it's funny because, you know, China in 2008
sure.
had its kind of coming out party as a developed nation finally, right?
Yeah.
And you look at what China did, and there were these awesome, opening ceremonies, and they built all this stuff, and it really just got done. There was limited streaming of the events, but you know, streaming happened, and there was tweets all over the place, and it was just kind of like, wow, China's arrived, all that stuff. Get to England. England is one of the most developed countries in the world, so it was really blasé. Oh, we're in England, it's whatever. The tech news there was that NBC was streaming most of it, although it was never, you know, you had to watch the stream in order to see it live. If you wanted to watch it on TV, it was always like time delayed. Now you get to Russia. And it's kind of like in this uncanny valley, right? You don't think of Russia as a developing nation, but it really is. It's actually one of the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Mm-hmm.
And because one of the reasons, frankly, because it's a whole bunch of white people, right? Europeans. These guys have it down. They figured it out. So when you see, and when you go to Europe as an American, you definitely run into funny things like bidet toilets and you know, driving the wrong side of the road. It's kind of weird things. But there are some funny things that have been tied into Russia's notorious corruption, and the fact that you know, Russia is not as developed. Sochi is not as developed as, you know, St. Petersburg or you know, Moscow or whatever. And it's great to see these things happening in real time, these tweets happening. But thing is, it's kind of, guys, you're in Sochi, Russia.
You're not in
the UK, you're not in the US, you're in Sochi, Russia. So
you're not even in Moscow.
Exactly. You're in the equivalent of what America would call the boondocks.
Yeah.
But you're not even in America, so there's that. You know, no heating, no internet, but it has a single bed, you know, the lifts are broken, They have pictures of Vladimir Putin on the hotel benches. There's a lot of stuff going on, but you know, whatever. The water isn't so good. This kind of happens.
I remember stories similar to this reported about Beijing back when Beijing was hosting the Olympics. And I think what it boils down to is, unless you're solidly a Western nation, a lot of these countries just do not, their infrastructure is not prepared for the massive influx of people that are associated with the Olympics.
Right. I think the difference here is that Russia reportedly spent $51 billion getting ready, which is the most expensive Olympics ever. And it's also interesting because it's a Winter Olympics and not a Summer Olympics. And people are wondering where that money went.
Right.
We've all seen the picture with the two toilets and the one stall.
Yeah.
Russia is notorious for corruption. So I think people are having a fun time poking fun at the apparent disarray. And the, you know, the fact that a lot of people, especially in the West, want to thumb their eye in Russia. And this is an easy way to do it. So, you know, Washington Post making fun of Russia, not surprised.
Well, then you're not going to like what NBC News has to say. There's little question at this point that the logistics in Sochi, from hotel rooms to public infrastructure, are in a mess. But one of the greatest threats to visitors is one they can't even see, according to NBC. It's a near guarantee that connected devices are being watched by hackers within Russia who use malware downloaded on smartphones and laptops to steal personal information. It can be assumed that visiting dignitaries, athletes, and journalists faced a particular risk when it comes to unauthorized access. NBC's Richard Engel came to Russia with brand new gear littered with fake accounts, testing the waters while limiting exposure to his legitimate data and contacts. The honeypot trap was a success, with Engel's Galaxy S4, Mac, and Windows laptop all compromised within a day of arrival. According to NBC, the U.S. State Department has informed Americans traveling to the Olympics that they should have no expectation of privacy while visiting in Russia. And if a device is infected, it could continue transmitting information back to the motherland long after tourists return home. There's a video associated with this article, and I saw the video, and it's fairly amazing how quickly, like, as soon as he turned on his Galaxy S4 in a public pub, there was a little notification on the phone that said downloading. And that means not that the phone was... It basically meant that the phone was automatically downloading malware that would then turn it into a bot.
Which is interesting, because you wonder, what configuration does he have on the Galaxy S4 that's allowing it to download stuff? Like, what device is like, oh, I'm on, I'm just going to download whatever's been out there. Someone's either got to be pretending they're Samsung or Google or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
He still has to be accepting it. You know,
well, maybe not. That's a good question.
That's the thing. So he's got to have a setting in there that says, yeah, accept from these types of whatevers. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Also, I think he was on Wi-Fi with that. It'll be interesting to see what the phone companies are compromised if he's going over, you know, Edge or 3G or whatever. For me, I haven't seen that kind of thing. I've never been exposed to that kind of thing on an Apple device. I haven't seen an Android device either, but I can see how a setting might allow that to happen. But yeah, it's a real concern, and you should expect that when you go to a place like Sochi, you're going to be taking your disposable phone, or you know that you're going to root your phone when you leave.
Right. Right.
Maybe you're going to get something like a Straight Talk or Net10 type device, something that just doesn't
a burner.
For lack of a better term, just call it a no contract device, a less frills device. Because, you're there to be focused on the games and not to be focused on your phone anyway. So,
yeah. Okay, moving on to non Sochi news. And this is it's Facebook's week this week.
Doesn't Sochi sound like a delicious thing?
It does. It sounds like some sort of ice cream, or maybe
because that's mochi. Mochi is there. It's ice cream with the rice stuff around it. And like Sochi, it just kind of sounds like, hey man, let me get some Sochi. It's like kimchi, Sochi.
Yeah.
Mochi.
Yeah.
You know?
It sounds like some dessert. I want it.
It's got the O sound of tofu.
Yeah.
And the chi sound of kimchi. Sounds delicious. I want some Sochi.
Me too. But not if they're going to be hacking me.
No, I don't want hack Sochi. I want like delicious, creamy Sochi.
Okay, so moving on. Facebook's new standalone app, Paper, is now available for download on iOS for everyone in the U.S. And it's more than just a content reader. Paper has messages, notifications, search, and a completely redesigned profile. Facebook released Paper this week, and it lets you choose different sections to create a sort of digital newspaper. You can then browse a redesigned newsfeed and your paper sections to read from stories from friends, big publishers, public figures, and emerging content creators.
It just comes across as a Facebook focused Flipboard.
It does definitely have Flipboard inspired elements.
Google Currents.
Uh-huh.
If you've ever used Winston, which is a news aggregator that speaks to you, so that you can, on your drive to work or whatever, like, hey, this is what's happening on your Facebook feed. Hey, this is what's happening on whatever. It's that. So it's not a new concept, which is one of the things, the big things that I'd like to.
But it is a new way to.
It's a way to get more productivity out of your Facebook feed.
Yeah.
If you're the type of person who likes the links on Facebook, one of the big problems is you're on the app, you open it up a link, and what to do then? Facebook, for a short time, allowed you to add it to your reading list on iOS, but they were like, oh, I don't know if I want that. It's too complicated, whatever. But, you know, the flow keeps on breaking in Facebook. You're looking in your newsfeed. Here's the thing. I'm looking over here. I got to go back. I want to share it. I can't, like, email it to the friend. I have to share it as a post. It's like, there's, like, a lot of stuff going on. So I feel like one of the big things here is that Facebook is trying their best to figure out a way to allow your friends to curate your news situation, to help aggregate it and organize it. And that's Facebook's biggest problem, organizing all that you've seen, read, or listened to, because there's so much data in there. And frankly, your posts last for maybe 3 hours when it comes to getting pushed down from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that you can get that news, get that stuff, it's one of the things that CNN's been trying for a while with their, like, specialized homepage where it's customized to what your friends are, you know, what's trending for your friends and stuff. Paper is it's a pretty interesting concept. I think it might get legs if it gets enough publicity. But ultimately, it's not a brand new concept, but just like how the iPod wasn't the first MP3 player, it might be the app like this that really takes off. Because while Flipboard got a lot of notoriety in 2011 or so, I really feel like it's one of those apps that people forgot about. The fact that this is directly tied to Facebook and the Facebook brand and all that stuff is something that I think that will allow this to continue to gain legs and continue to grow. Especially if you can do stuff like have it download the content when you're on an airplane or something like that.
I've been playing with Paper over the last few days since it was launched, and I have to say, one of the things I love about it that I never really sort of, I don't know if I was even able to access this through the regular Facebook app, but I'm glad that I have access to it now, is some of the non-friend feed stuff, like the news stuff or the specialized sections like tech and science, life.
It's very much like the New York Times, what's trending now, and they just kind of shove that into your chosen paper feed.
Yeah, it's just sort of an easy way to look at your friends' feed and all of this other stuff in the same newspaper style format. This was created by Facebook Creative Labs, which was a 6,000 employee subsidiary of Facebook, specifically designed to work on projects like this. Like,
it took 6,000 people to put this together.
I'm sure it's not the only thing they're doing, but
I'm sure. I'm just saying, you look at something like Flipboard. Flipboard does not have 6,000 people, 1,000 people, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just interesting. I mean, you need dedicated sky reachers, right? You need dedicated people on these moonshot projects.
Yeah.
So there is that, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy that they've got 6,000 people dedicated to this, and they have come up with a concept that is not brand new, and they've also stolen the name from a very popular iPad only app.
Yes, let's talk about that. Right, so, previously, Paper, the app belonged to a design startup called 53, and it was a it's a drawing app.
I love this app. I've been using this app forever. I don't use it to draw; I use it to write. I have a stylus. I use my iPad. Mm-hmm. You open up Paper, and imagine the Moleskine books you have. It's like that on your iPad. It doesn't do hardcore stuff like text recognition and so on and so forth, but it does allow you to quickly sketch out ideas.
Yeah, I love 53's Paper app because it really does feel like when you're using it to draw using a wet brush or a marker or something, it really does feel like that actual art tool on an actual piece of paper.
Yeah, it came out in 2011, 2012. 50 million people have this app. It's a free app with in-app purchases. You can purchase different, you know, pens, brushes, whatever. Stuff that really actually changes the experience. So it's not like a chintzy sort of like goofy app. And its name is Paper.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is just one of those things where I look at what Facebook is doing. And, you know, this app, the Facebook Paper app, reminds me of Paper.ly, a Twitter-based startup that used to suck your Twitter links and turn it into basically a newspaper. What Facebook's Paper does is it's playing with that concept. But fundamentally, I don't think it needs the name Paper. I'm not. I don't feel as if I'm on a newspaper or any other, you know, tree-based medium when I'm on the Facebook app. However, with the Paper app or 53 by 53 degrees, you're in a position that makes you feel like you're emulating actual paper, not unlike when you're on a Kindle and it's an e-ink paper display, that kind of thing. So it's an interesting choice by Facebook to choose this name, when in fact it doesn't really require this name. This name is not necessary to what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. So how is it that you think that Facebook was able to come in and like insinuate themselves onto somebody else, another app's trademark?
Well, this is just a question of names. Facebook decided to call it Paper. There's another paper out there. The first issue here is that Apple didn't care, and they said, oh, okay, whatever. 53 can, you know, they've got a pending trademark in the USPTO, and they can go out and they can file a claim and say, hey, they're infringing on what we're doing, and they can kind of fight there. So, but you know, what the situation is that, you know, Facebook put the app out there, Apple accepted it, and it's just kind of out there right now. 53 being upset about it, but I don't think any legal action has been taken. And Facebook hasn't said, this is our name, we're going to use it.
On the day that Facebook announced their app, 53 took a trademark application out for the term Paper.
Right, which is interesting because Paper is a very generic term.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's like, it's not like the word thermos or Kleenex, which are trademark terms that have become genericized. It's an actual thing. It's like saying box.
Yeah.
Right? Box.netbox.com. Calling yourself box. First of all, these things are problematic when it comes to SEO. So it's a question of whether this is a good marketing technique or not. But when it comes to the USPTO, the examining trademark attorney is going to say, well, your description needs to be very specific, mm-hmm. very limited to what it is that you're working with here. Because we can't allow you to control the word paper for everything, especially if you're not going to spell it differently than the generic term. Think about Citibank, right. CITI. Citibank owns that CITI. You can't really use it anywhere else.
Well, this is like the makers of Candy Crush wanting to trademark the word candy in any apps.
Correct. Just trademark the word candy and say that candy is candy means our game. Candy doesn't mean your game. So what Paper was able to do was call it Paper by 53. They were able to trademark that. Mm-hmm. Now Facebook is just calling it, you know, Paper by Facebook or whatever. So there's no real super conflict on the trademark side as far as the government's concerned. There's just a customer confusion issue So it's unclear where this is going to go. I have a feeling that, you know, unless 53 is very convincing, in talks with Facebook, Facebook's not really going to change.
They're the 800-pound gorilla.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are better names for the Facebook app that are more appropriate for it. I can think of five or six that I won't lay out here. But I don't think there's a big legal problem here for Facebook, and I don't think there's a big legal problem there. Facebook isn't going to go after 53 and say, hey, get rid of your term paper.
I think
they're both going to just have to share it and differentiate in specific ways. Facebook's ad and awareness budget is going to be bigger than 53's. 53's going to have to deal with that.
Yeah. We talked about this earlier over text. I'd mentioned that this reminded me of a similar case back when Linksys/Cisco had an iPhone device before Apple came out with their iPhone, and Apple decided they were going to use the term iPhone, and I don't think they even consulted or talked to Linksys at the time. And then Linksys had to file suit, and they negotiated over it. But I mean, how hard is it to do a trademark? Especially, I mean, Linksys at the time was a fairly big company, still is. I mean, Cisco is still a big company.
Yeah, it's about awareness in many ways, right? So, like, in 2007, when Cisco and Apple announced that they had resolved their iPhone trademark situation, mm-hmm. they basically said both companies are free to use the iPhone. But at the same time, Apple heavily put money behind the term iPhone in a way that Cisco simply had not.
Yeah.
You know, Cisco was there first. And Apple probably could have gone to court and said, hey, guys, hey, judge, hey, jury. Yeah, these guys were here first, but no one knew about it. And we're calling our thing the iPhone. Everybody knows about it. And this is what we put into it. Therefore, we should be able to have it. Luckily for Cisco, they were big enough in the room to say, that's not going to happen. Cisco since moved away from that product line, I believe. And Apple just kind of runs it de facto. But Apple had to come up with that. Same thing happened with the term Apple.
Oh, sure.
The Beatles label was called Apple Inc.
How could I forget?
And Apple was called Apple Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually Apple had to pay money to those guys. But in both of these cases, the names are exactly the same. The trademark names are exactly the same. In this case with the paper stuff, it's not. It's very different. And we're in a different era. Maybe Facebook will pay off paper to change your name, but it won't be for a lot of money. Right.
Yeah.
It'll be for something modest that says, just get out of here. But I don't even think that's going to happen. Paper's going to have to find a way to pivot, probably. Or they're going to have to find a way to continue to differentiate themselves. Either way, it's interesting. We have a language, just so many words.
Yep.
And people want to, you know, use what they can.
In other Facebook news, Facebook is celebrating its 10th anniversary this week. They created the social networking boom. They've reached 1 billion users, scaled their infrastructure, and revamped communications. In the last year or so, Facebook has navigated mobile, grown its advertising base at a rapid clip, and collected more data on people than probably any other enterprise in the history of the world. I think the users on Facebook constitute a number that is greater than – that is about the seventh largest – population on Earth, the seventh largest country on Earth.
So 1.2 billion people is the seventh largest country on Earth?
That
would be like the third largest country on Earth.
Maybe even more now. Maybe even more now. You're right. You're right. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Facebook is just, it's been a big 10 years for Facebook. And I think that they've got some challenges ahead of them, too. They still have the issue over user trust and privacy. And I think that's something that they've been working hard to sort of correct. But that's been an issue that's been plaguing them for years. Also, you know, they're having issues about sort of user decline, with other services like Instagram and what's the one that I never use with the well, now that they own Instagram, the one I'm thinking of is the one that I never use, but apparently all the kids are using.
Snapchat.
Okay. Yes, Snapchat. Oh,
okay. You don't use Snapchat?
All
the kids are using it? Is that what you said?
Apparently.
Dating yourself.
Well, do you use Snapchat frequently?
Yeah, I got to use it to talk to any of my cousins.
What? So you're only talking to your cousins in short, like 10-second clips?
Well, it's usually random and embarrassing stuff. Like, oh, the cat fell. Or like, someone farted or whatever, you know, it's not exactly high conversation. I look at Facebook and I say, Facebook has become the base, the foundation, for lack of a better term, of social media. Almost everything ties into Facebook if it wants to be successful. That's one of the things that got, Path never expanded because you couldn't tie it into Facebook. Foursquare, Untapped, Instagram, all these things allow you to take your activity on their specific network and push it onto Facebook. So that your wider community could see what's up, and your smaller community could feel special because they're part of the action without the overhead of Facebook. That's how it grew, and it's grown by this idea of break things and fix them later. It's grown by a few core concepts that I think may be diminished in light of its success and the fact that, you know, it's a big ship and you can't just turn it on a dime anymore. But, you know, they pushed the boundaries and changed our culture over the course of the last decade. And that's huge. That's really huge. I think you can't take that away from anything Facebook's ever done. Yes, they've had privacy issues, but part of that is because of that whole, we got to push the culture forward. The default is social. The default is out there. And it's forced our country to have to think about how they want to deal with personal information. If it weren't for Facebook, a lot of what Edward Snowden's doing today when it comes to our privacy wouldn't be as poignant, because for the last 10 years, our privacy, the hairs on the back of our neck that stand up when we worry about privacy, have been honed and have cared. So I think that Facebook's done a lot to move that forward. And these other tiny networks that are growing rapidly and that are doing whatever, they're just exploiting the holes that Facebook couldn't fill during its own expansion. And that's a good thing. The world is more social. You look at Twitter and what it's been able to do, and look at Facebook and how it's been able to connect families and people around the concepts around the world. It's pretty fantastic. I wouldn't say we live in a Facebook world, but our world would not be the same without Facebook.
I can't imagine the world without the influence of Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know how influential Facebook as an entity is. I think its core strength is its platform to make other people and other ideas influential. Jon Stewart would not be an influential social commentator if it weren't for Facebook.
Without the influence of what Facebook has allowed to have happen, which is the global sharing of information, not just information, but global sharing of our lifestyle with friends and family.
Well, I agree with that. I'm just saying that. When I think about the influence of something, the influence of Microsoft is Microsoft's ability to go into any tech market and shake it up. Or the influence of Apple is to, you know, destroy the phone sector and make it anew in their image. Destroy the music sector and make it anew in their image. Facebook has never exerted power like that. Facebook's core strength is letting the power of the individual shine through, and very democratically allowing certain ideas and content to rise up and become wildly popular. And that's what's interesting and different to me about this technology company as a staple of our lives, as opposed to the Googles and the Apples and Microsofts of the world.
Where do you see Facebook going in the next 5 years or the next 10 years? 10 years may be a little too hard to predict.
If Facebook's smart, they're going to move into the mobile payment space. they've got 1.2 billion people around the world. Having those people be able to do commerce with one another through their platform without restrictions will be very, very powerful. I think mobile payments, direct communications, you know, whether it's a FaceTime rival, Skype rival, or whatever, that's going to be huge if they put their money behind it. I think it might also be very helpful for them to move into the quantified self movement. I mean, they track so much of what you do. Can they help you track yourself better? Can they help you become a better you? Facebook has all those. They need some more big ideas behind it. So I think if they really want to get their foot in the door, they should think about buying some sort of meat space enterprise.
Really?
That'd be also really interesting. Hmm. Something where they're tied into something physical that you do, whether it's, you know, buy a grocery store, buy Costco. I don't know. Something that allows them to see how you're behaving in the real world would be helpful. But I think their advertising revenue has finally gotten to a place where it's big enough to give them significant profit and to have the shareholders take a breath. And they really just need to get into becoming a part of your everyday life in a bigger way.
I love what they're doing with people search as opposed to, you know, Google with the network search, like internet search, searching for other websites or things. What Facebook is doing with searching for specific people and categorizing people in a way that lets you find them by groups or by interests. I love that. And
see, for me, that's a little less interesting because, you know, boxing me into this or that, whatever. I do wish that they helped me figure out how to search my own timeline. Like, how much stuff do you post or put out there? Facebook could totally get into the space of, like, it's posted on Facebook and you can find what you can find out, oh, that article that I posted 6 months ago, where is that? I shouldn't have to scroll through my timeline for 6 months to find it. I should be able to type it in somewhere, the general idea, and see what comes back based on me and me alone.
Yeah.
Or just even like, oh, I know Andy liked it. So liked by Andy Sorcini.
But you know, when you think about it that way, that's kind of a weak spot for a lot of services like Twitter. Twitter doesn't really let you search your feed, your past feed.
Twitter lets you search concepts and other big things. Sure. It doesn't let you search.
Maybe that's the next horizon for these services, Facebook and Twitter and other personal services like Instagram or Snapchat, like being able to search your stream. How would you
exactly? I know if you're spending money, you can search Twitter for stuff. That's how a lot of surveys and studies come out. Oh, we looked at Twitter for these kinds of things, and this much stuff showed up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's if I'm going to spend all this time in your network, let me go back and see what I've been doing.
Exactly. All right, we're going to roll right into the drill down video of the week. And for the drill down video of the week, this is probably going to be the most personal for you drill down video that we've ever talked about, particularly if you are a Facebook user. So Facebook has this site on Facebook called Facebook.com/lookback. Facebook.com/lookback. And what it is it's a short personalized video highlight of the hundreds of millions of its users, in particular you. So it will take the information of the stuff that you've posted on Facebook, the pictures that you've posted over the last 10 years, if you've been with Facebook that long, over your history of as a Facebook user. And it will create a 62-second video of those highlights. And I tried it, and I found that I'm not very active on Facebook.
I'm sure that the arc is interesting for individuals. You know, in the beginning, not so much. And then just growing into this kind of like that all-encompassing 2007, 2008 moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then like kind of backing away as other things showed up and or people had children or, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm going to post my my own personal 10 years on Earth, 62-second life on Facebook in the show notes when we do the show so that everyone can see what mine looks like.
I have a feeling in 20 or so years, it's going to be a very popular thing to play at weddings and funerals.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know what it reminds me of? There was this movie with Robin Williams a few years ago where he played the editor. It took place in the future. And in the future, everyone is live streaming their own life, or everyone is recording their own life. And then when you die, you give it to this editor, and this editor makes a compilation of your life to play at events that celebrate your life, such as funerals or wakes or something like that. So he'll create like a review of your life based on all of this data that you've been accumulating all your life by wearing these wearable cameras that you have with you, like 24/7. There's a murder mystery involved in this movie too. I can't remember the name of the movie offhand, but I'll look it up.
Gotta love that Robin Williams.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of his serious roles. I think most of his roles these days are serious.
Well, except for the CBS comedy.
Yeah, 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 which is terrible. I don't recommend that one at all.
Hey, man, it's got Buffy in it. You leave it alone.
Have you seen it?
No, I won't watch it.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
It is about an ad agency, though, so given my background, I am interested in checking it out.
The movie is called The Final Cut.
Mm.
It stars Robin Williams, Jim Caviezel, and Mira Sorvino. It's worth checking out just for the sort of tech aspect alone. All right, so I believe that is it, with the exception of asking you, Dwayne, where can people find you when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter.com/DwayneD. You can always check me out on flavors.me/DwayneD and see if you can find me on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn? All right. I will see if I can find you on LinkedIn. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. Twitter and Facebook at Mr. Baby Man, and just type in Mr. Baby Man on Google, and all of my social network links are there. All my stuff is up there. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about here on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com or on Twitter at the Drill Down. We really want to hear from you. We want to get the feedback. I know that we have a fairly broad audience because I see the stats, but we actually hear from very, very few of you. So tell us how we're doing. Tell us what you like about the show. We want to hear from you. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. And let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.